Lake Effect continues on WUWM. I'm Mitch Teich. The history of LGBT cinema has always generally reflected the state of the LGBT community and its place in the world. In the 1980s, movies dealing with AIDS were in no short supply, and even today, they still resonate with the gay community. In the 90s, as the U.S. became more accepting or simply tolerant of gays and lesbians, LGBT films broadened into more than just movies about AIDS or being closeted or dealing with an unaccepting culture. These days, the selection in LGBT cinema is huge, branching into transgender topics, aging, marriage, relationship dramas and comedies, and so on. The 2014 Milwaukee LGBT Film and Video Festival opens tomorrow. Lake Effect's Dan Harmon spoke with the festival's director, Carl Bogner, and asked if there's still a place for the coming out movie or if that genre has become a relic.
It may testify to just the different concerns of LGBT filmmakers and the issues they're pursuing and the stories they want to tell. You mentioned coming out movies. We do have a share of coming out movies, but they might be different types of trajectories that the characters are coming out to than are normally represented. I think of this really great Australian film called 52 Tuesdays, which is a sort of – it's more about transitioning perhaps than coming out. It's a story of this one mother who is transitioning genders, and she asks her teenage daughter to go live with her father for the year, promising her that they will meet every Tuesday afternoon, that they will secure time together on each Tuesday of the year that will be their time. And the movie then proceeds to chronicle those Tuesdays where we see the mother transitioning and becoming more comfortable with her identity as James, and the teenage daughter also coming of age in a way. In many ways, she's acts out because she feels somewhat thrown over by her mother as her mother addresses some of her own issues. And the daughter explores her own sexuality and takes some stumbling steps towards being an adult. So that's a film that wouldn't characterize itself as a coming out movie, I think, but may speak to some of those identities that earlier films did, maybe more or more or less complicatedly, or treated a declaration as an event in itself.
Are transgender issues more represented in this year's festival, or maybe I'm just not remembering the previous ones too well?
Well, the festival always works to include films about and by trans filmmakers. So one thing that might strike you about the Rich Array is this year we have stretched from 4 days to 11 days. So the quantity of films or the diversity of films may be reflective of the greater elbow room that we have in terms of sharing work. And we've always worked to thread within the festival program works about trans identity and trans issues. And I do think this year's is particularly strong, but the festival can't take credit for that. I think it's just a fact that trans films have become more diverse in their pursuits, more complicated in the stories they tell, less burdened by a need to insist upon an identity, maybe more assertive of the complications that they would like to pursue. This filmmaker from Sweden, Esther Bergsmark, has made a number of experimental poetic films, and this year has this really great kind of raw, kind of punk narrative called Something Must Break about a genderqueer teenager who I love. She's probably my favorite character in the festival. I'll probably say that 4 or 5 times during the conversation. But she is stumbling into a romance, probably with the wrong object of affections, that's a poor selection. However, she's very defiant, defying her suitors, the world, to meet her on her own terms. I think she's really cool, and so's the movie.
Yeah, another movie that along those lines is combining transgendered issues with Native American issues, which to me is some new ground for LGBT Film Festival, Drunktown's Finest.
Well, we have shown Native American films in the past, and there's another documentary about the two-spirit identity, which will explore it at a documentary at UWM later this semester. But Drunktown's Finest portrays three youngish people, their early 20s, one of whom is a trans woman, and each of the characters is trying to negotiate or even find some kind of way to somewhere else. It may be off the Navajo reservation on which they live. The character Felixia, who is hoping to be included in the Woman of Navajo calendar, she sees this as maybe a stepping stone to a modeling career. is put her pursuits are put in the context of this troubled young man who's doing everything to avoid the responsibilities that seem to be foisted upon him. He's soon to be a father. He's agreed to join the army. And then there's also a colleague of theirs who has returned to the reservation hoping to find her birth parents. And in many ways, all three of these characters are trying to figure out their relationship to the reservation, the degree to which it's a home that can be productive for them. And so it's a nicely complicated work, I think, that contains within it a portrait of a trans character that's quite moving.
And let me just use this to ask a larger question, which
sure.
is a few of the movies, a lot of the selections I thought anyway, they weren't necessarily about LGBT issues. In my opinion, some of them, the characters may have been LGBT, but they weren't always about, you know, these bigger issues. It just might have been a movie in general, but it happens to have a gay character.
Like which ones are you thinking of?
Oh, like Cupcakes.
Uh-huh. Cupcakes, the musical Israeli film you're referring to, which features a lesbian character and a gay male character, is a film about the solidarity of friendship, I would say. I would say the spirit and the aesthetics of it. It's a pastel-colored, you know, really, you know, a very sweet confection, the story of six friends who together sort of kind of unintentionally become Israel's candidate in a Eurovision-type pop song competition. So I would say that there's something very queer about the aesthetic of the film, you know, in its candy-colored world, in this idea that this alternative grouping. I mean, these are people who, yes, are all paired in some way, whether with the same-sex partner or with a heterosexual partner at the end, are for most of the film the only sort of family grouping that we see. And I'd say the spirit of the song competition is led by this very flamboyant their flamboyant gay male friend who often performs in drag for the kindergarten class he teaches as they all work to realize the song written by their lesbian friend. So you're right in that it might not seem like an issue film. I think it's probably more concerned with ideas of Israeli identity. But it is a movie that's whose energy is forwarded with a mix of characters, both lesbian, gay, and straight.
Well, let's talk about
I want to say we do have, like, in terms of camp, I just want to emphasize that we have this very activist camp film, Goodbye Golly Mountain, an ecosexual love story.
You have to explain that, what that means to me.
Which part? Ecosexuality?
Ecosexual. Yeah.
Well, the movie is a very angry, urgent documentary about the destruction of West Virginia, or about the program enacted, imposed by the coal industry called mountaintop removal, wherein they do that to as this what's understood in terms of as an expedient way, they detonate drastically the top of a mountain so that they can have quicker access to the coal, but the runoff of the explosion, all the detritus that the explosion produces lays waste to the ecology in the immediate area. Beth Stevens, the director of this film, is from West Virginia. She and her wife, Annie Sprinkle, who some may remember as a sex-positive activist, come to West Virginia to share their performance art, which falls under the category of ecosexuality, wherein it's sort of based on the tenet, if we stop seeing the earth as our mother and instead see earth as our lover, what sort of attitude might that produce? In that they one of the things that they do in their performance art most frequently is they get married to the earth. They've gotten married to dirt. They've got married to the sea. These very flamboyant, specifically campy ceremonies, wedding ceremonies, which incorporate other styles of performance, incorporate members of the community, allow for platforms wherein people can educate others about the ecological dangers of such practice, but the criminal practices of these outside forces that are ruining the environment. So it's Goodbye Golly Mountain, an ecosexual love story, has the most political camp activity that we've showcased in the film in some time. So it suggests that camp still has an urgency of vitality.
I think the word ecosexual might confuse some people, including me. I don't know.
I think in part because it's a new term.
Yeah.
It's one that – and I think given that many of their performance styles seem campy, excessive, possibly silly. I think it diminishes the – it may make the term ecosexuality a challenge. It's basically – ecosexuals are basically positing for a different relationship to the environment. They would argue that if you're skinny dipping, that would be a form of ecosexuality. Consciously feeling the wind upon your body is a form of ecosexuality. In other words, embracing the sensual pleasures you get with engaging with the earth, the idea being that such a relationship may fortify attitudes that will help protect the earth. The idea of seeing earth as our mother, which many people probably may repeat, but I don't know if they hold to, clearly hasn't worked as we're a planet that's increasingly warmer, a planet of increasing scarcity. So their mode is what I like about what Beth Stevens and Annie Sprinkle are doing is it's risky. I mean, it's a mode that embraces humor and performance with also a very specific urgency.
I just want to ask one more about one more film, which is the opening night film, right? Blackbird?
Sure. I mean, Blackbird is probably one of our more conventional coming out stories, and it does involve the experience of a teenage boy embracing his identity. What complicates the story is that his friends in his high school are all with it, comfortable with diversity. He has a friend who is also gay, also keeping his secret. His other friends are keeping their they're sexually active, even if they're keeping their relationship secret, in part because they all live in a very evangelical neighborhood. The film takes place in Mississippi. The director, Patrick Ian Polk, deliberately moving his adaptation of the novel from southern Los Angeles to Mississippi, giving it, I think, a texture of repression that otherwise might not make sense in translating this 1986 novel to today. Because you do have high school kids who, like young people today, are comfortable with themselves in many ways and comfortable talking about themselves with each other. However, there's a home life wherein they might not get to be themselves, which is the case of our hero of Blackbird, who is a model student. He's a choir boy, for instance, but he grows up in a very religious household. That's also a household marked by mourning. His younger sister has disappeared, possibly been abducted. And so it's a stifling environment in which he cannot reveal himself to his family, it's a distraught mother and it's a fatherless home. So the movie chronicles his emergence as himself through the agency of his friends. The movie, it's a remarkable movie in the quantity of melodramatic elements that I believe it has. But I think smartly the director is more interested in the consolations that friendship provides, the bonds of support that parents and children and that classmates can give to each other.
And, hearing that, it sounds serious, but it's also lighthearted. It's not necessarily a downer of a movie, if you will.
If you will. It's a very entertaining movie. I mean, it's packed with incident, and it's I think it's remarkable that it never spins out of control. There's just like it's a really good ride. It's a very enjoyable film, and it features, it stars Monique in her first performance since winning an Oscar. And it'll be great that we'll have Patrick Ian Polk here to introduce the screening.
Great. And that'll be?
That's opening night, October 16th at the Oriental.
Tomorrow night. All right. Well, Carl Bogner, thank you for coming back on.
Dan, thanks for letting me talk about the Milwaukee LGBT Film Festival once again.
Carl Bogner is director of the 2014 Milwaukee LGBT Film and Video Festival, which opens tomorrow at several venues. He spoke with Dan Harmon. Keep listening, won't you, because the love songs of Stephen Sondheim spotlighted in a cabaret performance Friday and Saturday in Milwaukee. We will hear more about it when Lake Effect returns on listener-supported WUWM.